This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour on ABC Radio WA.
G'day, Jess Hayes with you again today. Great to be with you. Well, how worried should we be about the stability of the Australian canola trade? One expert believes the industry is dangerously exposed to potential policy changes in European markets.
So we need to find alternate uses for the canola that we produce, be that in the feed industry, be that in differentiated markets. So I think it's wise to try early on to examine what are alternative market opportunities for canola.
That's Professor Ross Kingwell, Chief Economist for AGIC, the Australian Grains Export Innovation Centre. We'll hear more from him a bit later. We've also got a pretty lengthy rainfall summary to get through today. Richard Hudson will join me just after 12:30 with those details. But up first on the Country Hour today, a new gold discovery near Kalgoorlie has sent shares in a Perth exploration company soaring today. Gibb River Diamonds owns the mothballed Ellendale Diamond Mine in the Kimberley, but it recently switched its focus to gold. The company's share price rose a staggering 422% today after drill results released to the ASX confirmed a new gold discovery at its Elgidina project. Jim Richards is the executive chairman of Gibb River Diamonds.
Clearly, with COVID around, diamonds have taken a second string at the moment to gold, and so we, being ever flexible, have moved into the gold space, and we've been extremely fortunate to pick up an option to acquire the Elgidina Gold Project, and our maiden drilling program there has just had a discovery.
Well, if diamonds are a girl's best friend, gold follows closely behind, like you say. There's Elgidina is about your project up that way. It's about 145 kilometres northeast of Kalgoorlie-Boulder. It's not far down the road from Saracen Mineral Holdings with their Carosue Dam operation. So you're in the right backyard for some gold. Now, you did some drilling in September. What have you found there?
It's about 14 kilometres of strike at Elgidina of old gold workings. It's a fascinating field, quite a dangerous spot as well, in fact, due to the amount of shafts there from old-timers. But there was a particular spot that we liked. We chased up a number of spots, but one, the old Mita gold mine there, which is a substantial old gold working there. There's been 16,000 ounces taken out at a grade of 47 grams per tonne historically at the turn of the 19th century. It was a good place to start. There was we banged some few exploratory holes into there and started getting very strong mineral alteration, and so we extended those lines out. When the assays came back, we were indeed in a major zone of mineralisation. Some of the downhole assays include 36 metres at 4 grams per tonne from 4 metres, 18 metres at 3.1 grams from 28, 24 metres at 1.4 grams from surface. So, you know, there's a substantial discovery there, and we're looking forward to developing it.
I'm speaking to Jim Richards. He's the executive chairman of Gibb River Diamonds. Now, don't let their name fool you. They've actually made a gold discovery 145 kilometres northeast of Kalgoorlie at the Elgidina Gold Project. Now, Jim, you've released the drill results to the Australian Securities Exchange Thursday morning, and the response has been pretty phenomenal. I'm looking at the charts now, and there's your shares have gone up 277%. And you said your phone's been ringing off the hook with brokers. So it's definitely timed it right just the week before Diggers and Dealers in Kalgoorlie-Boulder.
That was more by luck than judgment. That was because I can guarantee you I was still writing that ASX release and correcting typos in it up until 5 minutes before I let it out. But it is great timing. There's no doubt. You know, the stock has absolutely zoomed up today. We were up over 350% at one point today, and And now we've settled back to being nearly 300% up today, 4.5 cents up to 17.5 cents. And, you know, that's what we all love about this industry. You go for years and you work away diligently. And then eventually, you know, every now and again, you hit something like this. And it's really terrific to be able to reward a lot of our long-standing shareholders who've been in the company for many years, many of them for the diamond plays. So it's nice to reward them. And it's all onwards and upwards now. The discovery looks fantastic. It's got the, indeed, the Carisfou Dam Hall Road runs, Saracen Hall Road runs actually right through the tenement. In fact, it's got and there's in that field in the Eastern Goldfields there, you've got a whole host of different milling options. The field is big enough and potentially good enough that maybe we could set something up on our own as well. So it's got early days. That is our maiden drilling program. Literally, we only signed the option over this project less than 3 months ago. In that time, we've done all the database collection. We've done field trips, sampling programs, historical research, permitting, drilling, assay, and the announcement in less than 3 months. So that's not bad. I'm pretty proud of the team here at Gibb River Diamonds, and we're certainly a company going places, and we've got the project to help us get there.
Jim Richards, the head of Gibb River Diamonds, speaking to Jared Lucas about that new gold discovery near Kalgoorlie, Egidina. Managed to get at that time. Now, a short while ago, shares in Gibb River Diamonds were trading at 17 cents. So that means that the share price has risen by about 277% today. Now, moving to the state's top end, where hot easterly winds have decimated the Ord Valley's mango crop. Jeffrey Warnock is a mango grower at Pack Saddle Farm just south of Kununurra. He estimates he'll lose around 60% of this year's crop.
A little bit concerned about this year's season. Yeah, it's sort of not turned out as we would have wished.
Yeah, can you tell me why that is, Jeff? People were thinking it was the storm that just rolled through, but you're saying it was a bit of earlier in the season you ran into a few dramas.
Yeah, well, the flowering actually started in little patches. By patches, I mean an odd tree here and an odd tree there, beginning of May, and then it continued along this line until beginning of August, when for some reason the trees decided to have a proper flowering. But unfortunately it was a bit late, and on top of being late, we had about five days of fairly strong hot easterly winds, which sort of didn't do the flowering any good, and as a result of that, there wasn't much set. So this season is going to be very light in productivity, and you know, probably we will only produce about 40 or 50%, if we're lucky, of what we produced last year. It's not only been in this region. Darwin's had very similar circumstances, and also I think Catherine's been affected to a degree as well.
So that would be basically everyone up in the Yard then struggling with that for mangoes.
Well, above the 26th parallel. I'm not sure how Carnarvon has gone. They usually have their flower set by now, but I haven't spoken to anyone there for a few weeks. So,
Jeff, why does that happen? What does that actually do with the flowering? Why do you lose so much crop because of that?
I think, you know, the hot wind, the flower is trying to set, but, you know, instead of going through the normal process, the hot wind dehydrates it, so you don't get the fruit set.
Is that pretty devastating rolling into harvest season?
Oh, yeah, it's, it's whether you have a reasonable crop or whether you don't. It's controlled by the fruit set.
And so the storm that rolled through in early in the week, that didn't actually have that much effect on any of the farms, did it, in your area?
No, the strip of really strong winds didn't seem to hit any of the mango properties. It did a pretty good job on the light aircraft and the trees and that on the golf course, though.
So the forecast for the Ord was sort of around 150,000 trays, wasn't it, for this year?
Yeah, I think that's probably around about right, yeah.
everyone was talking about getting the workers in. What do you think that will mean now, that they won't need to come in now that it's basically been more than halved?
Yeah, well, they'll still require some workers.
Okay.
But, you know, to further exacerbate the very situation, you know, one of our transport companies has shut up and not cutting any produce. So, yeah, it's 2020 has certainly been a year of challenges. I just hope the growers can hold it together and focus on next year, you know, because it is the agriculture industry and you have peaks and troughs in that all the time. But, yeah, I just wish all the other growers the best of luck and hope the prices hold for them as well.
Kununurra mango grower Geoffrey Warnock from Pack Saddle Farm, just south of Kununurra, talking about those hot winds and how they've destroyed more than 50% of the Ord Valley's total mango crop. And from the sound of things, it's still a little bit windy up in that part of the world. It's just coming up to 16 past 12. Now, WA's first tropical rock lobster industry is another step closer to entering production, after another 30,000 spat were transferred to sites off the Pilbara coast yesterday. The juvenile oysters will be grown in baskets at West Lewis Island and Cossack over the next 18 months until they reach market size. After 3 years of trials, Maxima Managing Director John Hutton says it's an exciting development for the project.
So what we find with site selection is trying to find out of the major weather, but you want to also be able to put your lines across where the main winds blow. And as you can sort of see in the background here, we have the lines are across the wind, and it creates the situation where the basket has a gentle rocking movement as the wind blows across the water, and the shell are able to be knocked into shape, to the shape that you see on a plate. What you usually find with rock oysters is they're hanging on for grim life with predators and cyclone winds and all that sort of stuff and weather conditions. So what we're trying to create is a situation where they're basically the fingers or the growing area are knocked into a shape that becomes a marketable product that sits on your plate.
Pretty exciting to have the spat in your hands right now.
Absolutely. There's been 3 years of trial and error, and absolutely excited that the Pilbara black-lip rock oyster is now a whole 25,000-30,000 of them, babies, are ready to go out onto our first site, and really excited about the next 12 months and see how we go.
Maxima Managing Director John Hutton speaking to James Liveris. And that black lip oyster is expected to become a $30 million industry. But perhaps what's more exciting is that Aboriginal rangers will help monitor that farm over the next 18 months. Vincent Adams is a Yindjibarndi man. He says traditional owners are excited about the industry's potential.
It's about the future of our people and having something sustainable as an oyster farm. Within the environment that we live, I mean, you've got cyclones. There's other, you know, tragic sort of stuff that can happen to these oysters. But if we can somehow and manage to sustain the oyster farm and the employment with it, it goes a long way. Mining's quick and easy. As soon as the resource is gone, mining gone. So that prospect of understanding a sustainability doesn't sit with mining. Whereas the environment, the food, everything connects. It's our culture.
What role are the rangers hoping to play in this project?
The rangers that we see today and the role that they're going to be playing within this is massive. When you look at employment, training, but most important, their environment. You know, it's like I say, back trying to simulate the two cultures and getting the one outcome. It's going to go a long, long way in education from both sides of the fence.
And this obviously isn't a land-based operation. Do you think the young fellas will be pretty keen to go out there and learn the old farming techniques with the oysters? It's a bit of an old trade.
Yeah, no, look, it is. And when you try to, you know, guess what some of the other leftovers are, which is probably in the mining game, this, to me, has a lot more meaning than the mining game. Whereas we've been in the mining game for the last 30-odd years and, you know, when you look at the destruction that causes and the people that we have to get to work for that, it does drive a very sore bargain, if you like to say. You know, Whereas this project gives not only a sense of belonging, but gives a sense of achievement by paying back to Mother Earth, our country.
Vince, how keen are you to try the new black-lip oyster when they're done?
To be quite honest, oysters are a delicacy for us, and it's a seasonal thing with our sort of custodians that are here. So, you know, looking forward to tasting the oysters, but most importantly, looking forward to seeing our people taste these oysters.
Murujuga Aboriginal Corporation Chair Vincent Adams ending that report from James Liveris. A bit of an exciting development for that part of the world. We'll be sure to keep an eye on that one for you. Now, there's almost 3 months to go before the end of the year, but this has already been a record breaker for the number of West Australian sheep heading east. The official figures show more than 1 million sheep have already been trucked interstate. Matt Dalgleish is a commodity market analyst and co-founder of Thomas Elder Markets. He's been looking at the weather across the country and says it's highly likely more WA sheep will be heading east.
Generally speaking, I mean, it's not always the case, but with those La Nina patterns, often it comes across as a much wetter cycle for the eastern states. Certainly that's what we saw in 2010-11. And unfortunately for WA producers, what it often can mean, though, is that you do get occasionally drier times in WA, and certainly by the looks of the forecast, particularly in the southwest there of WA, you know, I think you're looking forward to a drier kind of summer, which is not the best scenario, but yeah, that's kind of the pattern that we tend to see.
There's been elevated demand for WA sheep from eastern states buyers this year on the back of the breaking of the drought for many areas. How many farmers would have gone all in on the strength of the rain this year, and how many might be sitting back? How much latent demand is out there, do you think?
Yeah, look, there has been a bit, and we have seen, if you look at the numbers that have come across from the west to the east, and particularly going into New South Wales, there have been a few. So that we do know that there already has been a bit of an uptick in the demand in the eastern states, and particularly New South Wales, for stock.
Put it into context for me, if you can. How much did New South Wales turn off during the drought? Like, how low did their flock get? Has it been totally restocked yet, or is there still work to do in that respect?
Yeah, look, the numbers in terms of the exact change to the flock size isn't quite out yet from ABS. That's a bit of a lag on that. But in terms of, you know, the question is the demand over? No, I don't think it is yet. The increase in optimism has only really been a phenomenon in the last month or so, and that's really been fueled off the back of the much improved outlook for spring, particularly on that east coast that the Bureau released about a month ago now. So really the big kind of increases in terms of restock of premiums and premiums of muttons, you know, it's been elevated for restockers through the whole of the year for New South Wales, but it really increased above what's considered normal in the last kind of 2 months. There would be the case, and it's not uncommon with farmers, that particularly when it comes to weather forecasts, have been burnt a few times in the past, these long-term weather forecasts. So certainly, you know, a lot of the anecdotal discussion is that they're very pleased with the forecast, but there would be some still that are probably waiting to see for sure if it's going to eventuate.
What's the situation in New South Wales and Queensland to a lesser extent with respect to rain and water availability? They have obviously had more this year than they've had for the previous few years, but paint a picture for me. I mean, how extensive has that rain been, and how widespread did it fall?
Parts of southern Queensland haven't got as much as what they probably would like, so there's still our areas into that southern area of Queensland which could still do with a lot more. The rainfall has pretty much been falling kind of central New South Wales in terms of above average deciles. You know, 3 months worth of reasonable rainfall leading into spring probably doesn't make up fully for the extent of the drought we saw through the last kind of year and a half, 2 years. But in saying that, if the Bureau forecast comes to fruition in terms of how much rain's expected for this next 3 months, that'll go a long way to get them right back on track.
And Matt, I suppose the logical conclusion to this, you know, leads to prices. West Australian producers have been enjoying pretty good prices this year in historical terms, very good prices for mutton especially. Do you think all of this points to a continuation of those sorts of market dynamics?
I think at least, you know, certainly for the next kind of 3 to 6 months, I'd say yes. Eastern buyers are going to still be about. There's a a real incentive to restock. Obviously, like I said, we've seen that building over the last few months, but the outlook, and particularly the outlook for sheep meat globally as trading partners start to recover out of COVID, and we've already seen it in the export figures for this month. We've seen a lift in lamb exports above kind of seasonal trends, and so that's pointing towards what looks like a recovery for offshore markets for lamb, and the outlook, the longer term outlook for lamb prices as a meat price is very, very strong. And in the last few weeks as well, we've seen what looks like the wool market's got a bit of a toehold. It softened a bit last week, but generally speaking, you know, those excessive selling periods, you know, one week after another of lower and lower wool prices seems to have found a bit of a base short term, and that's probably given some confidence there as well for the prospects for the wool market.
Matt Dalgleish from Thomas Elder Markets talking to Daniel Mercer. I'm keen to hear what you think about that one. Does it worry you if sheep numbers get really low? You're worried about how the industry and Associated Meatworks and live exports will keep up and keep operating? Feel free to flick me through a text on 0448 922 604. Just remember to pop your name on that one and tell me where you're from. It's 25 past 12. Now, members of the AGIC team were smiling last night because at a big grains forum, WA's agriculture minister complimented them for their work on innovation. Alana McTiernan then announced she's just given the tick of approval for an extra $2 million worth of funding to allow AGIC to conduct three more grain research projects. Richard Simonitis is the CEO of AGIC, which is the Australian Export Grains Innovation Centre.
First of all, I'd just like to say how much we value the support of the Minister and DPIRT as a member. They've been unflinching in their support for the whole 7 years that AGIC's been in operation. So, look, you know, this is a further investment into where we've identified great market opportunities for Western Australia and for all of Australia. And 2 years' worth of good, strong project work across three areas, so further innovation in oats to take the work we've already done on into more market-ready novel uses for oats, which take oats beyond just the breakfast table, an opportunity to take some market share from the Americans who dominate the soft wheat market for biscuits and cakes and cookies. We used to grow that stuff, it's low protein, it should work for us, we just need to get back into the breeding and the producing. And then to try and lock in the benefits for whole grain products using white wheat out of Australia, which has a clear point of differentiation in whole grain applications. It goes places that red wheat out of Europe or Canada just can't come with us and compete with us. So,
well, congratulations. And I'm glad to hear with that second project you referred to that you're going to try and get one back at the Yanks.
Yeah, we do like to... look, the Americans compete fiercely. They've just done some great work into the feed market in Indonesia. Every chance we get to demonstrate the value proposition for Australian wheat, we're happy to do that in any of our markets. And if it comes at the expense of America, that's even better.
A pretty happy Richard Simonitis, the CEO of AGIC, which is the Australian Export Grains Innovation Centre. We really do love sticking it to the Yanks, don't we? There are about 190 delegates at that GIWA function last night, and after the weather you'll hear more from that big grains event, because one of the talking points was how some of our grains industry might be vulnerable because they're very reliant on certain markets. We saw what happened to barley earlier this year when China decided to apply that 80% tariff. The question was asked last night, is canola also at risk, and is WA-grown canola overly reliant on European markets? We'll hear a bit more about that shortly. But it's time to get the news headlines now with Charlotte Hanlon. Charlotte, what's making news?
Thanks, Jess. Good afternoon. The state government is preparing to hand down its budget this afternoon with a focus on jobs and economic recovery. It's expecting to forecast a budget surplus this financial year despite the COVID-19 pandemic. Treasurer Ben Wyatt will address Parliament at 2 p.m. The Trump administration Biden's coronavirus response has featured heavily in the first and only US vice presidential debate held in Utah today. Senator Kamala Harris and Vice President Mike Pence also clashed over climate change, abortion and racial justice. And a Labor-led parliamentary inquiry into the summer bushfires is calling for a permanent aerial firefighting fleet and greater disaster recovery payments. The inquiry made 13 interim recommendations, including that the ABC be given extra funding for emergency broadcasting and that an increase to the disaster recovery payment and allowance be considered. I'll be back with more news at 1.
Thank you so much for that update from the newsroom, Charlotte. Now, time to head to the Bureau, where we'll get a bit of an update on what's been happening on the weather front. I'm joined by Luke Huntington. Luke, what's been happening across the Southwest Land Division today?
Yeah, well, we did have that cold front move over the southwest of the state last night. So did deliver some very good falls in the southwest district. Most places got between 20 and 30 millimetres, which is pretty good for October. And that's all cleared away now. So we're just left with some light showers along the coastline in the over western and southern parts of the Southwest Land Division. So that'll mostly clear by this afternoon. And tomorrow we'll see those showers just mainly about the coast in the southwest district, not too much about. And then by Saturday, they'll be mostly confined to the western and south coast around the Albany region. And by Sunday, we'll have the ridge fully developed. So no precipitation at all for Sunday and Monday. And we'll just see a trough develop through the central parts there. So yeah, that's pretty much it for the rainfall for the foreseeable future for the southwest.
20 to 30 mils, that's a fair whack. Where were those higher falls in the Southwest Land Division?
Yeah, so it looks like the highest fall was down the Harvey region, and Nanup, Dwelling Up, Manjum Up all received the 20 to 30 millimetres. That Harvey figure, 38.6 millimetres, was actually the highest from the event. So that's not too bad.
And what about in those northern and eastern forecast districts, Luke?
Yeah, over the northern part of the state, we're seeing some seasonal showers and thunderstorms over the north and east Kimberley for this afternoon. And pretty similar for tomorrow, just extending down into the interior. And that'll further extend down into the southern interior and northern Eucla on the Saturday, but probably clear away from the northern Kimberley there. And on the Sunday, any showers or thunderstorms will be confined to the interior and the Eucla and perhaps the far southeast Pilbara region. And pretty similar for Monday. Just on a trough line, those showers and thunderstorms will be confined into the interior Eucla and the far southeastern Pilbara. But yeah, in terms of the Kimberley, it looks like those thunderstorms and showers do clear out from Sunday, so we'll see an easing of that in that region.
Luke, any warnings?
The only warning we've got today is a fire weather warning for the Eucla.
Thank you so much for that. Thanks for that update from the Bureau, Luke Huntington there. Now, I'm joined in the studio by Richard Hudson with the rainfall figures. Pretty long list today. Richard, it's a shame that we didn't get that front a few weeks ago when grain growers needed it.
Yeah, that's right. Although I think some people still need it. But in the northern and eastern forecast districts, in the Kimberley first up, El Questro 44, Ellenbrae 22, Kachana 27 and Marion Downs had 10. And then no rainfall at all in other parts of the north and east. But in the Southwest Land Division forecast districts, nothing worth mentioning in the central west, apart from maybe New Norcia with 4. It doesn't quite qualify, but we'll drop it in there. They've got some nice beer there.
They do.
In the lower west, Anketell 13, Bickley 15. I can't be bought, by the way. Bindoon 22, except with beer.
I was going to say, I can with beer.
Bungendore 18, Dwelling Up 31, Gidgegan up 6, Gleneagle 9, Huntly 25, Jandakot 13, Jarrodale 11 to 15, Julimar Forest 5, Carnot 17, Carrigullen North 25, Lake Chittering 11, Mandurah 17, Mulyabini and Mouchet had 5, Mount Solis 21, Mundaring 8, here in Perth 7. I don't normally read out Perth, but it was raining when that grains function was on, so you know, I was intrigued just to see how much fell.
Yeah.
Pinjarra 15 to 18, Rolleystone 11, Serpentine 8, Waroona 18 and Werribee had 10. In the southwest, Acton Park 22, Aldervale 15, Bailing Up 18, Beadle Up 21, Boyne Up North 27, Bridgetown 23, Brunswick Junction 18 to 23, Bunbury 16, Busselton 18 to 22, Cape Naturalist 8, Capel had 19 to 23, Carlotta 21, Chapman Hill 24 to 26, Collie 14, Quorum Up 27, Darden Up 11 to 22, Dinan Up 13, Donnybrook 22 to 28, Doyle Road 20, Ferguson Valley 15 to 18. By the way, if I'm giving a range, it's because we have a number of locations in that area that send in their rainfall figures and I group them together. 4 Acres 19, Greenbushes 20, Happy Valley Alert Station 22, Harvey 39, Hentybrook 13, Jarrowood 28, Jindong 28 as well, Carriedale 11, Logbrook 25, Ludlow 15, Manjimup 17 to 24, Margaret River 21 to 26, Mayanup South 20, McAlinden 17, Millianup 15, Mount William 20, Myalup 37, Nanup 20 to 32, Newbuckup and Northcliffe had 17, Newlands 27, Paindale Alert Station 22, Perivale Orchard 19, Quinanup 14, Ravenscliff Alert Station 20, Rosabrook 20, Scott River 13, Shannon 19, Somcreek 23, Thompsonbrook 34, Tonebridge 22, Vass 19 to 26, Walpole Forestry 6, Warner Glen 13, Wilgarup 20, Willyabrup 32, Windy Harbour 9, Wychcliffe 23, Worsley Downs 19, Yanmar 23 and Yungarillup had 26. In the southern coastal region, Albany 7, Denbarker 6 and Mount Barker had 7 to 9 mils. In the central wheat belt, nothing more than 3 mils. Great Southern, Arthur River had 11, Boddington North 15, Boscobel 5, Chaming Up 11, Cherry Tree 7, Quartering 9, Cranham 5, Culford 13, Darkin had 13 to 16, Dumbleyung 5, Franklin 14 to 18 mils, Katanning 5, and the same for Kojanolican Hills, Kojanup 9, Maradong 13, Narrogin 7, Poppinining 6, Quail Up 10, Riverdale 8, and the same for Wandering, and Wagen and Williams both had between 8 and 9 mils.
Whew, probably need a bit of a break and a breather after that one, Richard. Now, you went along to a grains forum last night. I know all sorts of things would have been discussed, but I hear canola was talked about a fair bit, Richard.
Yeah, and one of the things that was mentioned was Australia's canola industry is actually dangerously exposed and probably needs to start looking for alternative markets and value-adding opportunities. It was a bit of a stern warning, actually. It was the annual pre-harvest forum held by GIWA, which is the Grains Industry Association of WA. The keynote speaker was Ross Kingwell. He's the chief economist for AGIC, which is the Australian Grains Export Innovation Centre. And Professor Kingwell he's pretty worried the European Union might suddenly change its renewable energy regulations.
I think that's true, that 70% of the canola that is exported from Western Australia predominantly is used for biodiesel production in the European Union. So we are very exposed to whatever happens in the European Union. And the demand for our canola that is used in biodiesel is predicated on the Renewable Energy Directive policy. And that requires feedstocks that go into biofuel production in the European Union that they have a small emission footprint. Now, fortunately, in Australia, we've been able to prove and verify that the way in which we produce canola, the way in which it's delivered into the European Union, is a very small emission footprint, and that gives us lucrative access to that market. But if there is ever a change in that policy, if, say, they tighten regulations or raise the environmental bar and we can no longer satisfy that, then immediately we lose access to that market. And that is an exposure that we need to be mindful of.
And the point was raised by our agriculture minister here in Western Australia, Alana McTiernan, at the start of the function that we're at now, saying, I suppose that is a possibility. And the reason she thinks it's a possibility is when you look at it logically, especially from an outsider's perspective, does it really make sense environmentally and sustainability-wise to be growing canola, broadacre here in Western Australia, shipping it all the way across to Europe to then be burnt and used for vehicles.
Sure, that's true, what she says. But the flip side of that is that previously the feedstocks that were being imported into the European Union were actually very emissions intensive, such as palm oil, and therefore the emissions that were being generated outside of the European Union in order to provide that feedstock were actually worsening the global climate situation. And so substituting away from those feedstocks to more environmentally friendly feedstocks such as Australian canola is actually an improvement in the global environment. However, as you say, what happens if there is a further policy change? What happens if there's a lot greater use of electric vehicles in transportation system and we move away from liquid fuels? Then there is the opportunity for that market to be eroded. So, yes, we do need to be mindful of the impacts of policy change.
And I suppose not just of policy change, but we will get to that stage eventually, won't we? So I suppose the writing's on the wall, as you say, with electric vehicles.
Yeah, so we need to find alternate uses for the canola that we produce, be that in the feed industry, be that in differentiated markets. So I think it's wise to try early on to examine what are alternative market opportunities for canola.
Well, John Slee is the Managing Director of Alba Oils. Are you worried about that threat?
I am. We're very aware of the threat, and we also see it's an opportunity in some ways. And because the industry has been focused on supplying that European market, we have been making sure that our production systems are sustainable. We've had fantastic segregation of GM and non-GM product. So the bar has been set pretty high, and Western Australian and Australian farmers have actually stepped up and put systems in place to be able to meet those requirements, as well as the whole supply chain through. So if over time, whether it's a change in policy or the second generation of renewables or that sort of coming through and different, whether it's the electric car or that reducing that biofuel type market, I think we're really well positioned to get our product into other markets, and it's probably more the markets that are looking for sustainable production of the food supply chain and is prepared to pay a few extra dollars for that. We've already got our systems in place, so I believe we're going to be at the top of the dance card when it comes to switching and going to other markets. And when we look at the oilseed market, it is a 600 million tonne per annum market, or that for oil seeds. Western Australia in a good year is 2 million tonnes. So trying to shift and get into other markets, our supply is really just a drop into that huge ocean. We want to make sure that we're actually at the top of the list and top of the dance card to get there. And I think we are pretty well situated for doing that.
You've got a multi-pronged business. Can you just explain how you're involved in that industry?
Yep. So we've over time, it became really an integrated business. So initially, I was involved in just the crushing business down at Cogenup. Then the family that owns the refinery bought into that about 6 years ago. And we've added on a third leg, which is doing bulk oil delivery direct into end users, such as Crown Casino, where we are today, or that, but all the major pubs around Perth. That we've expanded that now into Victoria, and we do Crown over there. And also we've got a large footprint over in New Zealand in the Auckland market doing the same, where we're delivering fresh canola oil, bulk, no packaging, low carbon footprint, sustainable production, and our processing methods. We don't use any chemicals in our extraction or in our refining of the product, so it's all chemical free along the processing, which makes it sort of unique. And we've used that to step outside of the normal canola commodity oil sort of market that's generally just the cheapest cooking oil on the supermarket shelf. We've done that to differentiate ourselves or that out there and our product. But I think Australia, we can do that even into the global markets with our canola seed, the same sort of principles we've used. And one thing of the method we've done, we've bypassed some of the food distributors. We are in direct contact with the end user, the chef. We're looking at the same sort of thing of actually going direct to the consumer as well, of trying to bypass the you know, some of those other hands in, so you can, if you do that, you can actually tell the story of what your product is, and you change buying patterns by doing so.
Well, I mean, speaking of getting the rug pulled out from underneath you, I mean, we started by talking about the what ifs and the maybes, but you've just gone through that with the COVID pandemic, haven't you?
Have indeed. Although, as I mentioned, a big part of our business was supplying into such things as Crown Casino, Optus Stadium, all the major pubs around Perth. When COVID hit, they all shut down overnight. So that part of our market, we lost 85% market overnight. With our business being that integrated supply chain, our crushing plant, a big percentage of the product coming out there is a protein meal, which is going into the livestock industry. Well, that it's all just in time. Our plant runs 24/7 all the time, just keeping up that supply of the protein meal. If we had turned the key off because we had lost our oil market, we would have had a much bigger problem on our hands, or that of no protein meal going into chicken feed or pigs, and whether it was the Inghams or a Steggles or other poultry producers would have been jumping up and down and would have flowed on to the consumer. So we had to shift the tiller very quickly, open up some other new markets. There were some industrial ones that we did, that whether it was drilling greases for exploration, it was explosives, it was spray adjuvants for farming, but also some export markets that we'd built contacts up with over the years. I sent out hundreds of emails or that reconnecting with those sort of contacts, and we're now exporting product to Vietnam on a regular basis, got product going into Taiwan. We're looking at some first shipments up into China as well, but they aren't in that main commodity low price sort of market. They are actually where the consumer is looking for that supply chain integrity that we can deliver from Australia.
And has that evolved in the last 6 months due to the COVID pandemic, you mean?
It has. So that it did make us have to shift very quickly.
You had to go looking.
And we had to go looking very quickly. And when I say quickly, it was like within days, not weeks or that. What are we, 8 months on? Our crushing plant has lost 18 hours of production because of COVID, which we had to shut down during Easter because our tanks got full.
Jeez, how slack's that, Ross? 18 hours. You'll have to do something about that next year.
So, yeah, I'd have to say we're pretty proud as a business of actually being able to shift as quick as we did. And a lot of those markets, I've now, I'm a bit embarrassed to say, I've got the other problem of I don't have enough supply. I've got too much demand. I've ordered another press out of Europe or that to get here as quick as possible.
Wow.
So it has been a bit of a health checkup for us when COVID hit. Luckily, we didn't get infected, but we've got our house in better order coming out the other side and created new markets that are going to be there for years to come.
What a roller coaster ride. You have segued into the next thing I was going to ask of you, though, Ross. I was very intrigued with one slide that you had up today, and that was a change in the meat eating trends here in Australia. There was the lamb, beef, chicken and pork. Yes. Can you just describe that graph for me?
Sure. Australians for many, many years have annually consumed between 100 to 105 kilograms of meat per capita each year. But what's changed is not that volume of meat that is consumed by each person, but the composition of those meats. So if you went back to the 1970s, the main meats that were consumed in households were beef and lamb. And chicken in that era was quite expensive, and it was probably the least consumed meat. So people would talk about the Sunday roast, which was the roast chicken. It was that rare, that expensive, that you hauled it out to impress your guests on a Sunday lunch. Whereas now, the ranking of meat preferences are that the most popular meat consumed is chicken, followed by pork, then beef, and lamb. In fact, as a nation, we consume less lamb now than we did back in the mid-1970s. And lamb is the new chicken. That is, if you want to impress your house guests, you roll out the lamb roast on your Sunday. So that huge change in our meat preferences, driven by the affordability of those meats, is actually a benefit to the grains industry, because those main meats consumed, that's the chicken and the pork, are underpinned by grain feeding. So when we grow in population size in Australia, and we maintain that preference for meats, which seems to be unchanging, then the grains industry in Western Australia is going to benefit from that, because there's a huge local demand for feed grains to fuel the meat-eating habits of Australians.
And crystal ball gazing, is that trend going to continue, do you think?
I think it will, because, again, if you look at the genetic improvement in chicken and pork production, chickens and pork are very efficient in converting grain into animal protein. That's less true for beef and less true for sheep and lamb. And so just the basic conversion rates means that chicken and pork are likely to remain the most affordable meats. And when households feel that budget constraints at work, and in a post-COVID world, that's probably going to be the case for a while, households are going to be very careful in the sorts of expenditure that they make on meat. And therefore, I think chicken and pork will remain preferred meats, which in turn means that the grain that underpins their production is going to continue to be demanded.
Is that an opportunity for your business and your industry, John?
It is, for sure, and I've been in the canola industry for about 22 years now. When I entered, just our domestic processing in Western Australia was only about 30,000 tonne. Of that, we're now 90, pushing 100,000 tonne. A lot of that is that shift to the poultry and the pork, which need more nutritionally dense type diets, so they're looking for higher quality feed ingredients or that. So canola meal's been one of the ingredients that's really benefited from that sort of shift, and I think we'll continue to do so. Well, that we're still an importer of soybean meal into Western Australia, so over time, if we could actually replace that with even more locally produced veg proteins or that, I think there's huge opportunities as well.
Been very interesting chatting to the two of you. We've taken a good look at some of the threats, some of the things that have gone wrong, but wow, there's been some opportunities and some positives to come out of it all, haven't there?
Yep.
Yeah, there has indeed, and you know, I think if we stand here in 5 years down the track, there's going to be ones that we haven't even thought of today that's doors that'll be opening. So.
Nice to chat, Richard.
Yeah, thanks for your time on the Country Hour, both of you.
Professor Ross Kingwell, Chief Economist for AGIC, that's the Australian Grains Export Innovation Centre, and John Slee of Oz Oils Kojonup, and also the General Manager of Alba Edible Oils. They were chatting to Richard Hudson about last night's annual GIWA Forum held in Perth. Quick text in from Paul at Bolgart. He says, the European canola market has been exposed for what it is. Green utopia that makes no environmental sense. He says it takes 9 times more energy to turn canola into biofuel than drilling a hole in the ground. And, of course, reduces ag land available to grow food and feed humanity. How wrong is that, he says. And I've got another text in here, but please remember to whack your name on that one so I can read it out. Feel free to flick me through another text. Now, grain growers fear freight delays could stop headers in their tracks if spare parts are needed during harvest. In the eastern states, many machines haven't left the sheds in years due to the drought. And now, between port disputes, reduced flights, and other issues brought on by COVID-19, wait times on parts have blown out. Some businesses are doing their best to prevent any problems, but as Amelia Bernasconi explains, a lot of growers are getting nervous.
The winter harvest is finally making its way down the eastern states. Of course, it hasn't been without its dramas, from diseases to pests, frost and a lack of in-crop rain for many parts. But nonetheless, it's hoped to be the season to start the financial road to recovery after years of drought. There's just one final hurdle to clear: getting the crop off. Cameron Rowntree, who farms at Walgett in central west New South Wales, says his biggest concern at the moment is not being able to source machinery parts.
Making sure there's, for breakdown purposes, we've got the right parts on farm, or at least in the shops in our suppliers in town. The problem is the fact that there's no, from our suppliers' perspective, there seems to be a delay on the simplest parts. It seems to me that the excuse has been either COVID, or it's hard to get freight, or it's hard to get them off the port. So yeah, really, really frustrating and a major concern to us, because we've all had 3 shocking years in a row. So it's really critical that for breakdown purposes we can access parts when we need them.
The clock is ticking, and Mr. Rowntree says he's not the only one waiting for parts and machinery.
everyone. I've just heard a report today, a bloke's waiting on an auger that he's actually paid for and it's no longer there, you know, and the auger's not turned up. I'm waiting on tarps, I'm waiting on parts for augers, and they're coming, but, you know, if they come after harvest, it's a waste of time. So we don't need it in 6 weeks, 8 weeks' time, we need it now.
And what kind of significant financial outlay is that as well?
Huge. I mean, we're talking thousands and thousands of dollars that we must have swinging in the wind here for parts and for stuff that to make their harvest effective and efficient. If it doesn't happen, we can be the best farmers in the world, but, you know, if you get a breakdown, you've got no part, well, that machine becomes useless. You know, it's got to be better than that, simple as.
Anita McFadgen manages the spare parts department at two machinery dealers at Narrabri and Moree in northern New South Wales. Much of their stock comes from Germany or a warehouse in Melbourne. She recalls the issues that were thrust upon them earlier this year when Australia was forced to close its borders due to COVID-19.
It definitely started to happen once all the international flights were reduced and there was no overseas travel happening as frequently due to COVID. So it ended up becoming a waiting game on when you would see your part. It could be anywhere up to 5 weeks before you'd see a part from a supplier overseas. Air freight's normally guaranteed the next day, but now it's taking 3 to 4 days just because there's no flights in the air.
Knowing how crucial this harvest is to growers and the wider community, Ms. McFadgen put the call out to customers to get their orders in early to hopefully avoid a parts rush during harvest.
We did a huge order coming into harvest. We actually sent out a letter to all our customers advising them of freight issues. You know, it could take up to 5 weeks to get something from Germany to get in early so they had their parts. And we had a lot of people that did, which was wonderful. Yeah, but now it's all coming back to normal. Our main harvest supply class in Melbourne have increased their stock holdings considerably, so they should have the parts available as well. We're pretty lucky. I've had many Zoom conferences with all the class dealers across Australia, and we've all agreed that if they have a part, Melbourne doesn't, and we need it urgently, we'll help each other out. So hopefully with that in place, we'll be able to ensure that customers get their part and can harvest on time.
Let's hope so. Anita McFadden ending that report from Amelia Bernasconi.
Hello, I'm Sally Sara. Coming up on The World Today, Queensland sets a deadline for its southern neighbour to contact trace the source of several mystery COVID infections. Is New South Wales at risk of another outbreak? And in a rare move, one of the United States' most prestigious medical journals slams President Trump's handling of coronavirus. We'll hear from the editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine. Join us for those stories and more, all coming up on The World Today.
And there was a cattle sale at Mount Barker today. 1,065 sold, up 138 on last week. Tracy Kilner's at the Mount Barker sale yards. Tracy, how did the sale go? How did you go, Tracy?
We had 1,065 head of good quality cattle. The lightweight weaner steers were in demand from graziers and backgrounders, with steers selling to a top of 458 cents. And the lightweight weaner heifers topped at 392 cents a kilo. Heavy cows topped at 268 cents to ease, while heavy bulls sold to a high of 286 cents to processors. Bullocks weighing between 600 and 750 kilos made 306 cents. Grown steers weighing over 500 kilos sold for 358 to 360 cents. And lighter weights under 500 kilos made 350 to 380. So the grown heifers weighing over 540 kilos sold for 260 to 280 cents, while the lighter weights made from 258 to 356 cents to average 315 cents a kilo. Yearling steers weighing over 400 kilos sold for 356 to 380 cents, and lighter weights made from 370 to 426 cents a kilo. Heavy yearling heifers sold from 340 to 372 cents, and lighter weights returned 300 to 394 cents, averaging 365 cents. Weaner steers weighing over 330 kilos made from 402 to 426 cents. Steers weighing between 280 and 330 kilos sold for 400 to 440 cents, and the lighter weights returned 400 to 458 cents a kilo. Weaner heifers weighing over 330 kilos made from 360 to 384 cents, and lighter weights sold from 348 to 402 cents a kilo. Heavy prime cows eased 5 cents, returning 220 to 268 cents. Medium cows sold for 228 to 274 cents. Lightweight cows made 238 to 240 cents. Boners sold for 180 to 218 cents. And store cows sold from 186 to 204 cents, depending on quality. The heavy bulls gained 5 cents, selling for 230 to 286 cents to processors, while the bulls sold to a restocker for 314 cents a kilo. Medium weight bulls made from 274 to 280 cents, and lightweight bullies gained, making from 306 to 356 cents, with live export and feeder buys active on these. This has been Tracy Kilner for Meat and Livestock Australia's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Thank you so much for that update, Tracy. Now, just on that discussion earlier about meat consumption, I've got a text in here from Peter from Narrogin who says, what about goat? Haven't actually tried goat, Peter, but I'm sure, given my love of meat, I'd probably very much enjoy it. Now, if you're a fan of the mullet, a bit of business at the front, party at the back, there's a cracker of a photo on the ABC Rural Facebook page. Beck has sent us in some fantastic pictures of her pet sheep, Fuzzy, sporting that absolutely sleek look. And look, remember, if you're chasing any news at any time, you can always jump on our website at abc.net.au/rural. That's all from me today. Thank you so, so much for tuning into the Country Hour this afternoon. Always great to have your company. It's news time now, heading up to 1 o'clock. Time for the news.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.